Hey, this is Bob Stelton from the Bob Gross and Tom Show. I want to thank you for listening to the John Clayton Show. And you know what would be great is if you checked out the Bob Gross and Tom Show every day from noon to 3. You can stream us live at 710sports.com or on the 710 Sports app or listen on demand.
John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
Boy, what a busy Monday this is. There are a lot of things going on in sports. And, of course, we're not going to waste any time. We're going to get into it with the top five stories of the day. The top five is brought to you by Eastside Funding.
Number one.
He was a, everything they say, he was a tough guy. He was a nice guy. He was completely honest. Absolutely, you could bank on him to follow up on everything he said. He had one thing that I thought was really kind of interesting. He did not like to play young players. He didn't like to play rookies. So we would have these draft choices come in, look really good, play well in preseason. I'd say, Chuck, what do you think? Well, oh yeah, we're going to play him. He's the first game. Well, you're going to see him a lot. Of course, he never saw the field.
And, of course, the sad news yesterday, the passing of Chuck Knox, Ground Chuck, at the end of 86 years of great living and great coaching, and we all miss him. I moved out here in 1986 and had the pleasure of covering Chuck Knox. I mean, it was just so great because he's from Sewickley. I'm from Braddock, PA. We talk the same language, and he was so, as John Nordstrom just said, so open and honest with what he was able to do, and a lot of conversation and a lot of things. We're going to talk to Gary Wright at 11:30. PR guy who was with him all the way through his Seahawk career. But what a great coach, a coach that was able to win in three different cities with the Rams, the Buffalo Bills, and then he made the first successful run of the Seahawks, you know, getting them into the playoffs and making him viable. I mean, he was able to come here in 1983. His record was 80-63 for 9 years. He was voted the coach of the year three times, and really that was on the AP vote, and he won twice on the UPI vote. But what a great coach and what a great person. Chuck Knox, we miss you, and it was such an honor to be able to cover him. I mean, he made football fun. He was able to get the ground game going. He was able to get that offensive line going in a great direction, and he just had that toughness. And again, coming from the same area, I mean, I appreciated it so much, because being able to talk the tough talk that he was able to do, it was just such a pleasure to watch Chuck Knox. We'll be spending a lot of time during the course of the show going back and forth talking about Chuck Knox, who passed at the age of 86.
Number two.
They haven't said anything. I mean, it's broken like bad. So it's kind of, we got to see what the specialist says tomorrow. So maybe surgery, and we go from there.
And, of course, the bad news, a bad injury for the Mariners yesterday, and we are taking you around the diamond thanks to Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. Robinson Cano gets hit on the hand, the broken right hand. Looks like he's probably going to have surgery. It was an 88-mile-an-hour fastball coming from Blaine Hardy, and he's going to see a specialist Tuesday, so we won't really know how long he's going to be out, but it looks like he's going to be out a big amount of time. He was batting .287, four homers, 23 runs batted in, and had not missed a game all season, and really hasn't missed many games in the past 11 years. And so he's going to be out. Now the decision comes down. Do you move D. Gordon to second base, where he was an all-star last year? Do you keep him in second, in center field? Or does Gordon Beckham, who's been real hot down in the minors in Tacoma, do you bring him up? Beckham is hitting, by the way, 300 with a 912 OPS in Tacoma. So a big decision coming up here. But what a bad loss and what a bad series it was for the Mariners over in Detroit. But losing Cano with a fractured hand that may require surgery, it's that fifth metatarsal that was injured and broken, and that was a bad one. So he's going to be out for some period of time.
Number three.
The stretch by Nicasio and the right-hander's pitch on the way. Swinging a ground ball up the middle. Base hit in the center field. Jones will score, and the Tigers win it by a score of 5-4 here in the bottom of the ninth inning on a walk-off single by Jose Iglesias. And for the first time this season, the Mariners lose a road series. The Tigers win the series 2-1.
And a very concerning loss, I think, in this one, because first they had the rainout, the doubleheader, now the loss of Cano. James Paxton was solid, going six innings, giving up three runs on six hits, but runners in scoring position just did not go, and Juan Nicasio continues to really struggle. And there was all the, remember the debate that was there about, okay, it's tied up in the ninth inning, and do you go to your closer, Edwin Diaz? A lot of people were critical of doing that because Diaz ended up losing that one game because Nicasio that game before gave up two runs in the eighth and it was on a James Paxton game. Well, guess what? They end up going to Paxton, and what he does is lose the game. So that's been bad. And I'll tell you, the one concerning thing I can see for the Mariners is that their schedule has been pretty light in the sense that, okay, the road schedule has been against a lot of bad teams, and right now they're five games over 500, which is good, but they're only like six runs in the run differential, and that's not good because that's more of the 500 team. 22-17 the Mariners right now, but that series loss is going to, you know, really hurt, and now they have to try to make up that game in Minnesota today. 4:10 will be the start of the game with 3 o'clock on the pregame, but the Mariners right now losing their first series, you know, which of course, you know, they lose the home series right now to the Angels and also to the Astros. But on the road, they've now 23 games on the road. They've been successful, but a lot of it's against teams that aren't very good. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business.
Number four.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's a really good shooter. He's a good offensive player. I never worry about shots not going in game to game. He'll make shots. And then I thought, you know, by committee, everybody worked hard. You just have to keep, you know, make it as hard as possible on LeBron. Easier said than done. He's obviously not going to have many games like that. Their shooters around him won't have many games like that. But I thought our guys were locked in, and, you know, we're just going to have to be that again.
And the Celtics won big over the Cavaliers in Game 1, 108-83, and it wasn't even close. That's Brad Stevens talking after the game. And, you know, it's funny. I know Dave Grosby and I talked about this on Friday and Saturday, thinking, okay, are the Cavs getting back to the NBA championship going against maybe Golden State? I'm starting to really wonder now. Now, I thought maybe, you know, with the Celtics down, their top two players, Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward, you know, the Cavs would have an advantage. But here's the things that I look about. Even the lineup the Celtics have, I think in a lot of ways, even though it doesn't have the great one in LeBron James, may be better than what's still out there for the Cavaliers, because you really think about it, three of the top six players in the Cavs came over in trades over by the trade deadline, or at least somewhere around that time. And you look at the Celtics, and they got some good young players, even though they're down their top two. But here's the big difference. Brad Stevens going against Tyronn Lue. I just think that that's such an advantage right now, because Brad Stevens is about as good in coaching in the NBA as you want. I now have switched gears and now starting to think that, hey, maybe it's going to be the Celtics getting in. But a big victory. They resume the series at 8:30 Eastern time on Tuesday. That's going to be in Boston. Warriors and Rockets go at 6 p.m. tonight.
Number five.
I played really good today. I hit it so good. It was nice. I control of it from tee to green. I made some putts. I felt good on basically every facet of the game. And it's weird, you know, not to really miss hit a shot today. And I want to shoot 300 par is just weird.
Well, Tiger Woods wasn't going to win, but I think the victory that he had yesterday was the fact that he really played well and sets up the chance to maybe do well. He was at the Players' Championship. He started the day tied for eighth, 11 strokes behind, and then moved within four, and was at one point 14 under in second place. But the big thing is he was hitting just about everything. He had a tee shot in the water on the 17th hole that got a double bogey, but in the end, I think you can see that he's going to win sometime reasonably soon. Tiger Woods having a very good tournament, and that's encouraging for golf, and you can see ratings go up with Tiger Woods doing well. Hey, you can listen to my show in the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Coming up, we're going to break down and go under further review and actually talk about the loss of Chuck Knox, who meant so much to this city, so much to the Seahawks, and that's going to be under further review. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app. Under further review with John Clayton.
We'll review the play.
And with under further review, what we do each day is kind of break down something that's going on in sports. And of course, what happened on Sunday was the unfortunate passing of Chuck Knox. and what he meant to this team, what he meant to the Seahawks. 86 years old, 9 years, 80-63 record. But the big thing is that he made Seattle a playoff team, a playoff contender, a Super Bowl contender every year. And so I think that was the great part about it. And a lot of people bringing back some of the memories. And I know that Dave Wyman was real emotional trying to remember Chuck Knox.
He was very quotable and a lot of times would make you laugh.
How about this one? Dave Wyman of Danny, Dave, and Moore with us. How about the current Seahawks today, Dave? As close as you are to the program and the pre and the post game and doing games, and we're there an awful lot in training camp, who are the Seahawks of today that would have thrived in Ground Chuck and for Chuck Knox in your day?
Ethan Posick, guys like that. He just popped into my mind because when we interviewed him last year, he's like, I just like playing football. And, you know, he's just all about football. That's kind of Chuck, old school, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't think he would have been – Chuck was very intimidating. You know, and I know Pete's a different kind of coach, and he gets different things out of players. And I think Pete can be – I think he's more of an old school guy than we all think. But, you know, that whole story about Michael Bennett supposedly reading a book, which Pete said wasn't true, and I believe him. But I can't imagine anybody, you know – acting that way around Chuck Knox. I mean, you'd be out of there.
I guess, Dave, he'd fire you. How did he balance? Because I hear so much of this, and I think of Coach James as well. And Don James used to sit up above the practice field and, you know, hardly even talk to players. How did Chuck balance that fear, right, that he created with also just gaining respect? Because I think a lot of times those old school, you just have fear and negative and fear. But how did he and how was he able to, I guess, command also equally that level of respect?
Yeah, it's interesting, Brock. I think some people have it and some don't. And so that's why when, you know, they've talked about head coaches and, oh, this guy could be a good head coach. And, Tom Catlin, he's the finest coach I ever had, defensive coordinator, just brilliant mind, really good the way he taught. He was very consistent. Tom was not a head coach at all. He just didn't have that it factor. Chuck, you know, it was just the way he carried himself, the way he talked, the way he addressed the team. I mean, when you went in that, I remember the first meeting I ever went in, it was everybody was talking after I was drafted. It was the first meeting of the year and everybody's, you know, talking and chatting and laughing and all this. And Chuck walked in the room and the place just went dead silent. And that was the kind of respect that he just had. And it comes from, you know, having worked your way up and all that. But also, I just think it's the way you carry yourself. And certain people just have it and some people don't. Chuck had it the most was that he said, you know what? It's been a good life. It's been a real.
And Chuck Knox really did have a good life and was such a good person and meant so much to everybody. And, of course, he has been missed because, again, I know his health hasn't been good of late, but, you know, 86 years old on his passing. But the things that I remember, and I know the one thing that they keep on saying about Chuck is like, well, gee, he never went to the Super Bowl. But there was two chances that really could have put him over the top. I'm sure that, I mean, he was really hoping that back in 84 that there was a chance to get Warren Moon. Because Warren Moon was available, he ended up going to the Houston Oilers, and the reason that he went is because Houston was offering a guarantee, and that was against the policy of the Nordstrom family as far as the full guarantees, and so it didn't happen. If you would have, and again, he had good quarterbacks. I mean, Dave Craig was so good for him, but still, the Warren Moon would have put him over the top, and still, I still remember the one draft when it was going to be down to Browning Nagel, Dan McGuire, and Brett Favre. And I know he wanted Favre because that was the perfect quarterback for him. He was pushing for him, but there was a tie in the room among the scouts and all that stuff. And the vote finally went over to Ken Behring. And Ken decided, hey, let's go for the 6'8 guy and Dan McGuire. And I know Chuck wasn't too happy about that because he really did want Brett Favre. Brett would have been the one, I think, that would have taken him back over the top again. So but still, the great success. His game plan was always so good because it was going to be ground Chuck. They were going to run the ball. They were going to try to make sure that they win the right way, set up a good defense. He had great coaches around him. I think that's the one thing that was also so good. He knew how to hire coaches. And, of course, when you're as successful as he was, you know, being able to be in three franchises and make them all winners, whether it was going to be the Rams, the Buffalo Bills, and the Seahawks, I mean, he had such a great staff. I mean, you know, Steve Moore, the offensive coordinator, George Dyer, Tom Catlin. I mean, all these coaches were so good that you knew that they were going to get the most out of each player because each player was having the best coaching possible. And so Chuck was able to coach it up. And again, he had that great presence. And a lot of coaches, you know, they're kind of quiet and, you know, they'll, you know, don't commit. As Dave Wyman says, he just commanded respect because you never knew what he was going to say, but you knew it was going to be honest. And if things weren't going the right way, well, he's going to raise a stink, and it wasn't going to be very good for those that weren't doing good things. But in the end, he was able to win and win often and win well. And that so speaks of what Chuck Knox has meant as a coach. And I know that each year his name, you know, gets in the initial wave of the Hall of Fame voting, and, you know, it hasn't got to the point. But again, a lot of coaches still need to get into the Hall of Fame. That may happen sometime in the future. But yeah, what a great loss, and what a great coach, and what a great career that he had. And, you know, he's so missed. But that's the big thing from this area. I mean, he established the Seahawks and got them on the map. Because and that wasn't expected. He did the same thing with the Buffalo Bills. He got them on the map and did so well with them. And just to be able to pull and get Knox was a great stroke of genius by John Nordstrom. And you know, John cared so much about winning, cared so much about, you know, being a successful franchise, that getting Knox was one of the keys to being able to do it. And you know, then you're listening to John Nordstrom talk to Brock and Salk today, you know, he just reveled in seeing the success of Knox, because again, he was what you want in a coach. I mean, he was going to make sure that the players listened. He made sure that they did all the right things, and he was going to be in control. And that's what was so good about what was there with Chuck Knox. And of course, the loss of Chuck is such a bad one. But again, you know, we can celebrate today the memories of Chuck Knox, and I hope you have some good memories, because again, if you go back in those 9 years, it was fun. You knew that this team was going to get better. You knew it was going to be on the verge of getting to the Super Bowl and maybe one more step. And again, Dave Craig was so good that maybe another would have gotten them over the top. But again, what a great time it was to be able to cover the team. And when he was there as a head coach, it helped from my standpoint that he was a Pittsburgh guy. You know, we talked the same language, and he was so good and honest with me. And really, when I was at the News Tribune, we just had so much fun. He was so willing to be cooperative, and I was also willing to go out and chase him every day. I mean, every day I would wait till the end of his day. I'd still be there in the press room. The press room was right by the parking lot. And I would run out every day when he was walking out just to make sure I didn't miss anything. Because, again, you never knew what things were there. But he was so open and honest, and I really appreciate that. But the great thing is, for this area, he was so successful as a head coach. He just did everything right, and he did everything perfect. And, again, Chuck Knox, and, again, we'll talk to Gary Wright, who was there for all those years, you know, doing PR and watching how Chuck developed. And, you know, Gary was one of the great fans of Chuck Knox. And, of course, he had the great background because, you know, some of the guys that he knew were Jerry Tarkanian and Jackie Sherrill, and he was around some great ones. But he has some great memories of what we saw in Chuck Knox. And of course, that's what we're kind of reviewing and going under further review. Chuck Knox passing at the age of 86. Hey, coming up, we got to find out what's going on with the Mariners. Bad injury after this Detroit series, and they're going to be in Minnesota. Robinson Cano waiting on Tuesday to get that hand checked, and it looks like it's a bad fracture on the right hand. Shannon will update us on the injury, what they might do. Will they move D. Gordon in? Hey, it's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, just when things start going right, something goes wrong. And yesterday, something went wrong because Robinson Cano was hit by an 88-mile-an-hour fastball and suffered a bad fracture, fifth metatarsal on the right hand. Joining us on the Venue Kings hotline is Shannon Dreher. So, Shannon, how bad does this injury look?
Well, you were kind of hopeful when you heard originally what the injury was, and the fifth is the one that is kind of the easiest to heal usually. But when we got down to the clubhouse, Robinson himself said he thought that it was broken pretty badly, and he thought he was probably heading towards surgery. quite often with this injury, surgery is not required. Can heal like in a cast or wrapped with treatment in about 4 weeks. If you do have the surgery, that does take longer. So we're waiting to hear what the final diagnosis and recommendation is. He's flying to Philly today to see a specialist tomorrow, and we should know more then.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, you can see the pain that he was in. And, you know, so it can be maybe just about a month as far as if he does have the surgery.
I think it would probably be a little bit longer if he did have the surgery. I think he would probably be looking at a minimum of 6 weeks, but I don't know. I don't want to put anything on it until they have their diagnosis. But I've talked to some people about the injury, and, you know, a best-case scenario would be 3 weeks. Worst scenario would probably be about 8.
Which is not good whatsoever. So now that creates a lot of maneuvering that has to be done. First, what do you think they do at second base?
Well, I think the immediate thing we'll see is probably Gordon Beckham up today to take over at second base. And, you know, there's been a lot of question. Could we see Dee Gordon? Of course, he's a Gold Glove second baseman there. When Dee Gordon was acquired, Jerry DePoto said, no, we are going to put him in center and keep him there. We're making that commitment to him. And I think that when that question was asked, it was asked, well, if somebody needs a day off, would you move him in to play second base? And this, if it goes longer than a few weeks, I mean, maybe you reexamine what you said with that. And in that case, if you were able to put Dee Gordon at second base, you could put Guillermo Heredia in center. He is your best defender out there, and at least kind of beef up that defense while Cano is out. But I think for that move, if you had Dee Gordon just for 1 year, I think you would make that move in a heartbeat, but you're committed to Dee Gordon for the next few years. So I think that almost has to come from him. And I think we just need to kind of wait and see what transpires there.
Yeah, and of course, I guess he can get his name, because again, he's done such a good job in center field.
He has done a good job in center field, but it's not been the easiest thing for him, and he's always been up front with, I'm still learning. You know, everybody else in the league has been out there for many, many years. He's been out there still for just a matter of, you know, days and months. So I'm going to be interested to see what turn that takes, and I think it very much will be in his hands if they ask him or if he approaches them. I don't know that they would ask him because that commitment was made. I don't think it is something that if it did happen would happen tomorrow. I think they'd give him a little bit of a chance to kind of warm up and get into that. So I think that you see an immediate move today, which obviously you have to make, but I don't know that the move that we see today is what we necessarily are going to see until Cano comes back. Could go either way. I'm not completely dismissing the idea that Gordon could end up out back at second base.
How do they rearrange the starting lineup now? Because, you know, he is in that number three slot. Who moves into the number three slot?
Well, it depends what they want to do there. If they want to stay with the left-right, I think you'd probably see Kyle Seager, who has actually been swinging better the last couple of weeks, up in that three spot. So, I think there's going to be a lot of things that they can play with there. You know, do you go with left-right matchups at that point? Because this lineup had been as solid as we've seen in years with this team. So do you have a lefty lineup and a righty lineup in that case? Or, which I don't necessarily think you'd have to do because Seager hits lefties very well. Or do you try and get something kind of solid at that point? But I think that, you know, that would probably be the most logical thing to do at this point. If Mitch Haniger was hitting like he was in, you know, mid-April, I think you could see him up there, but he struggled the last 10 days. So I think there's a lot to take into consideration there. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw Seager there to start with.
Interesting. That's going to be something that they have to really try to fix up and make sure, because Seager could fit in very well. And how much do you think this takes away as far as just the run production, not having a Robinson Cano?
Well, the toughest thing is Robinson Cano is such a tough at bat in that lineup. It's not just what he produces. It's what, you know, he brings to the lineup and everybody around him, and just kind of that length of the lineup. The other thing that they could do is just move everybody up and have Nelson Cruz hit third. And then all of a sudden you've got kind of that kind of weaker spot at the bottom of the lineup where you hadn't had that before, you know, particularly when Ryan Healy was hitting ninth and could hit the home runs as well. So they've got kind of two different things that they could do there. So, you know, production and what Robinson brings in his own numbers is one thing, what he brings to that lineup and how it just really does not provide a break, not only for the starting pitchers, but when you get into the bullpen, I think it's twofold. So it's a big loss.
Juan Nicasio continues to struggle, came in on the ninth inning, which, of course, alleviated that debate about, okay, you put Edwin Diaz in if it's a tie game, and, you know, there was some criticism of that. But Nicasio coming in, of course, giving the walk-off hit that ended yesterday's 5-4 loss.
Well, a couple things there. I mean, they're going to play it at home, where if you don't play Edwin Diaz, if the game is tied after the eighth, if you do not pitch him, he's never going to pitch in a game with a lead that it starts out tied at home, because they hit at the bottom of the order. So I think that's not a big thing. On the road, I think it's a natural that once you do get the lead, that's when you go to Edwin Diaz. And Nicasio, while it looks like he struggled yesterday, I think his biggest struggle was just not being able to get that first hitter out. He got the grounders. I mean, that's what you're looking for him to do once he has those runners on situation. But the problem was, is he had one of the fastest players on first base, and that was the problem when he got that, when he got to that point. I think that with the runner on first base, he had Healy trying to hold him on. Had he not been trying to hold him on, that grounder over to first base would have been gobbled up, and that would have been an out. So I'm not particularly alarmed with what I saw from Nicasio yesterday, other than that first hitter. When you come in that situation in a close game, you've really got to get that guy, and he didn't. The fact that he gave up the game-winning run, I think a lot of that had to do with what you saw once he did get on first base. Saw a ball that was hit right between Seager and Segura, but again, on the ground, you know, 6 inches to one side, one of them gets it, it's the out. You don't have that runner on first base, ball's hit to first base, and Ryan Healy's got it, and you're out of the inning. Unfortunately, he didn't get that first guy.
Yeah, he did not. Now the Minnesota game coin tonight. I mean, what fatigue factor is there? Now, again, Friday turned into an off night because of that long wait because of the rain and all that and the weather. But now this trip to Minnesota, which was supposed to be a day off, but now they have to make it up. I mean, I would imagine that's going to be a little bit of a drain on the team.
I think they're okay today. I actually ran into a couple players downstairs earlier today, and they commented that they got some of the best sleep that they've had on the entire trip. We got in at a reasonable time last night. It's not a day game today, so I think today's going to be okay. I think the tough part is going to come up tomorrow and on Wednesday. You know, Mariners aren't going to get into town until the early, early morning hours tomorrow, because we've got a night game tonight. And then Wednesday is a day game. So I'm thinking Wednesday, Thursday is when they're really going to be hurting.
Mm-hmm, no doubt. What series against Detroit was a tough one because, again, Detroit is in a rebuilding mode, and first loss of a trip on that because they've been so successful. But the schedule was broken right for them on the road games. They've had a lot of winnable teams to play against.
They have, and, you know, you're going to run into that number, be it at home or be it on the road. I think the toughest thing with the road trips has been the game times. I mean, there's been nothing normal about it, and we're already a month and a half into the season. So I think that they're actually getting through part of the toughest parts of their schedules right now, get a little bit deeper into it, and they're not going to be crossing over the Mississippi for a long time. And I think that that's going to help them quite a bit at that point. So I think that what they've been able to do on the road right now is important, and those are kind of those wins that you bank. I don't think it's been easy. In April, you were missing so many players, and then the entire time, the travel has been weird, the game times have been weird, the off days have been weird. You haven't been able to get into that kind of regular routine yet, and I think that all of that is just about behind them right now. So the fact that they were able to kind of take advantage on the road was great. Now they got to get home, get settled in at home, start winning games there too.
Yeah, no doubt. How's your fatigue factor?
I'm okay. I had a rough one at the beginning. I don't know if you heard. I lost my voice on the first couple of games of the road trip, which was just fantastic with a no-hitter. Was not able to do a pregame show for the Paxton game. Somehow found the voice in order to do the post-game interviews and the post-game show, thank goodness. But other than that, you know, long day at the ballpark the other day, and then a frustrating day in game one in Detroit. That is a game that should have been called hours before. We perhaps shouldn't have even had to go to the ballpark, but we did, had to wait out a long one and then come back and play two the next day. But it's baseball. You know, you're going to have that once or twice throughout the season. Hopefully that's all behind them now.
Why did they wait so long?
I have no idea. I had a suspicion because it was Star Wars night there, and they had a lot of pregame festivities, and I thought that maybe they wanted to get all that out of the way before they canceled it. But, you know, a lot of times what they say is, you know, anybody that gets in the gate, there are things that can be sold in the stadium, so they do that. There are parking revenues, things like that, that you don't get back if you go. So I don't know. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's if there's any chance that you can play, you want to do that so you don't have to do the doubleheader. You don't have to come back. But that was a day where it didn't look like there was ever going to be a window or a chance that they were going to play. So, and they didn't even call. They didn't even announce that that game was going to be delayed until the start time. So that was, to me, a very odd one.
Yeah, it was just kind of an odd weekend trip in Detroit. How's the buzz with the fans with that team, the Tigers?
With the Tigers, you know what? I really don't know. I didn't get out and about at all. I mean, I know it's a tough thing for them. You know, they've had kind of a couple of different hits. They've been trying so hard. Mike Ilitch, their owner, is somebody that just threw so much into that team with the hopes of getting that World Series, and he's, you know, done so much for the community in Detroit, and, you know, great philanthropist, great Detroit citizen, and he passed away in the offseason, and I know that that was very tough for everybody around the Tigers community. So, you know, I think that this is a tough year. It's a rebuilding year. It's nothing that they've seen in a long time, although you don't have to go too far back to see. You probably have to go about 13, 14 years back when they were having 100 and 105 lost seasons. They've had some rough times there before, so I think there are probably a lot of questions right now about the direction that they're going. They've got a new manager in Ron Gardenhire. They tried to go kind of more that analytical mode before, and it didn't seem to work out for them. They've thrown a lot of money at the team, didn't quite get to where they wanted to be. So I think that right now it's just kind of a quiet time for them as they figure out, you know, what they are going to be going forward.
Yeah, because, again, they're one of seven teams, I guess, on pace to maybe lose 100 games. Well, Shannon, of course, game time is going to be 4:10 today, 3 o'clock in the pregame. And keep us updated on Robinson Cano. I guess we'll find out more tomorrow. But, again, looks like a bad break on that right hand. Hey, Shannon, thanks for joining us in the Venue Kings Hotline.
Anytime, John.
Okay, and of course, you can check out the show in the 710 Sports app, driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Well, the big news came out this morning that the Supreme Court in a 6-3 decision, you know, said that you can have legalized gambling in the states, that Congress can maybe do something to change any of that. We're going to get into what this all means. Brett Smiley, editor-in-chief of sportshandle.com, will explain the decision and how quickly you can have gambling in places other than Vegas on football games, baseball games, you name it. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app.
No surprise, the Supreme Court ruled that you can have legalized gambling on sports in the state. And joining us on the Venue Kings Hotline is Brett Smiley, editor-in-chief of sportshandle.com. And so I guess the league just came out with their statement, and it looks like the league is trying to push Congress to kind of slow this down, because that's the one thing that I guess in one of the decisions that Congress can at least adjust this. But how do you read where this is all going to go, Brett?
Well, you're right. Congress, in the first place, when they passed this law, they could have said outright that sports gambling is illegal. But what they did, which is eventually its undoing, was say that the states cannot authorize or legalize. The position they're in now is basically trying to influence Congress to pass such a law that doesn't ban sports betting, but sets up a framework that is more favorable to their interests.
Yeah. What do you anticipate Congress doing this or not?
Absolutely not, especially not in this session with midterms coming. I don't think they're going to be doing much of anything except funding the government. Now, what's interesting, come 2019, there are some signs, without trying to become a pollster, that the House could turn blue, which means that Frank Pallone, a New Jersey representative who has been active in sports betting, could try and push through a piece of legislation that would make a federal framework.
Now, of course, I get the word that maybe as many as six states may be able to get something in place before the start of the football season in September. If so, which states would they be, and how would they try to implement this?
Well, New Jersey is going to be one of the first movers. Of course, they were behind this legal battle for a long time now. So they may take their first bet at a racetrack in northern New Jersey in about 2 weeks, and Atlantic City should be up and going before NFL season, like you said. Pennsylvania, West Virginia have already passed laws that were contingent upon what occurred today. Delaware, they were grandfathered in their pass list. They're going to be ready to go. Mississippi should be ready to go. They're excited prior to football season. And I believe both New York and Michigan will have something done. Their legislative sessions are a bit longer. So if my math is correct, that's about 7 by the end of this year.
What do you see as far as, I mean, do you get any indication about the state of Washington, where they might stand?
Washington is, it's a bit tougher because there are a lot of Native American tribes, and their compacts with the state make it a little more complicated. Oklahoma and Connecticut are seeing the same type of thing. So the state is obviously progressive, having been one of the first, if not the first, with legal marijuana. But I think just reconciling the tribal state compacts might delay it a bit, perhaps 2020 or 2021. But a little bit slower as a result of that.
Ultimately, how many states do you think will legalize sports betting?
There were probably about 20 states that were having conversations in the first few months of this year alone, and it's not a red-blue state thing. It's across the country. There's about 38 states that have gambling and casinos, but only a few of them actually got a bill done. To actually answer your question, I think by the end of next year, we might see 18 states that have legal sports betting in some capacity.
And how do you see it being set up? I mean, would it be more online stuff, on cell phone type of things, or how do you think that's going to be put together?
The goal of most of the lawmakers is to give the licenses or allow existing casinos to apply for a sports gaming license. They'll be taxed, there'll be an application fee, and each of those casinos will have some sort of mobile component. So let's say, for example, New Jersey, all the Atlantic City casinos, 6 or 7 of them, as well as the racetracks, will have a license. They then will put it online. So it's not like, you know, any random Joe can set up an online sports book. There'll be few licenses set up through casinos, and they'll have apps. Now, whether you actually need to go into a casino to set that up, as you do in Nevada, that may be not the case. And for, as a matter of convenience, hopefully that will not be the case.
How much money is going to be generated by all this?
I think people are envisioning a greater windfall than is actually going to be the case. Right now, the American Gaming Association estimates that there's about $150 billion in illegal wagers placed annually. I think it's probably a bit higher. Nevada currently sees about 2-3% of that. So the states should see something in the order of millions, tens of millions in state tax revenue, depending on the amount that they levy. So we're talking real dollars that can really benefit the states, infrastructure, teachers, education, that type of thing.
And of course, how much do you think is going to be generating money for teams in different sports?
Well, that's part of the ongoing battle. As kind of a hedge against what occurred today, the NBA and Major League Baseball were at the forefront in lobbying in a variety of states. They want a, quote, integrity fee, which is more like a royalty or an intellectual property fee, actually getting a direct cut of wagers. So far, states have not been receptive to that. That's why they want to go to the federal government and just have one law that enables them that. That said, Mark Cuban has been outspoken, Adam Silver, they understand that sports betting is beneficial to them. They've seen that with fantasy, and they see that with their ratings. And so they'll benefit that way. You may see more partnerships. I don't think, betting logos on the jerseys, but advertising on their games and ratings should increase as well. So they'll benefit indirectly.
And what about, I mean, some of the, because I know you gauge the fantasy power in football, how much that enhanced everything. What do you think of the changes for football will be now that they can at least have the chance of legalized gambling?
I think they're probably going to look more closely at making sure that in each casino that players, coaches, trainers, maybe some lower rung individuals are not able to place wagers. That's sort of an integrity aspect to it all. They ought to work closely with states, gaming commissions to ensure that there's no funny business or that type of thing.
Yeah, and I would imagine the NFL still somewhat trying to fight it, but it looks like it's going to be a losing fight. How do you see them ultimately embracing it?
Well, they actually, at the most recent owners' meetings, they were discussing it, and I read from Albert Breer at MMQB that, you know, some of them are kind of seeing green. They want their annual revenue to get up to $25 billion. It's currently at, what, 14, 15 billion?
So about 14.
I think they are seeing, yeah, they are seeing the potential benefit here. And, you know, they have aspirations to move into China, possibly using sports betting as kind of an entree because maybe they don't quite understand the game yet. So I think between ratings, new partnerships, I mean, you just look at the engagement that they have in NHL with the Golden Knights. I think we'll see the same thing with the Raiders, you know, sports wagering in the stadiums. And, you know, the battle cry for a long time, not just in betting, has been the integrity of the game. You know, so long as they have adequate measures to ensure that, this is really only a good thing.
Yeah, no question. And I would imagine that injury reports become that much more important along with all the information and metrics and things like that. Hey, so how's everybody got to get your information?
Oh, please go to sportshandle.com. We have a betting legislation tracker that'll show you the latest on where the legislation is at in your state. Obviously, today is a huge day, so just a news around that and more opinion and analysis to come. And certainly a watershed moment. You know, dating back to Paul Tagliabue, who is behind PASPA. So,
very good.
Nice.
Brett Spiley, intern and chase of sportshandle.com. Go to sportshandle.com and get that information. Hey, Brett, thanks for joining us in the Venue Kings hotline.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, we're going to adjust the schedule a little bit because we're going to talk to Gary Wright at 11:30. And so what we're going to do is change things up. We'll do the report card coming up next. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.